This is an interview with the Honourable Dr. Bruce Eastick AM on Thursday the 27th October 2016 at Bruce's home in Gawler, South Australia. This interview is part of the Rosewood Agricultural College Oral History Project. Bruce graduated in 1947 with a Rosewood Diploma of Agriculture, number 608. Bruce, thank you for this opportunity to explore a little of your past experiences at your time when you were at Rosewood.
Yeah, more than happy.
Right. When I looked through your CV, I felt that I'd been almost standing still compared to your journey through life. It had a fairly a lot of things on there. Anyway, we only have time to explore a little bit of your background. So let's start with your early school days and go from there.
Yeah. Well, I was born at Reed Park, which was on the side of Colonel Light Gardens, and therefore the primary school was Colonel Light Gardens School. From quite early life, I used to spend a lot of the school holidays and Christmas up on the farms at Alford and Avon in the lower north with relatives. And by the time I got to year five or six, I determined that my destination was to be a cocky. And that was foremost in my mind. It followed on that having graduated from Colonel Oak Gardens Primary School at the end of 1939 with the grade 7 examination, I elected to go to Erbray Agricultural High School, which was the only one at that stage which was in South Australia, and sought to assist people who were looking for a destination in agriculture. I used to ride a bike from Reed Park up to Erbray each day, and was there for a total of 4 years. Erbray had only started in 1932, so going there in 1940, I was one of the early people associated with Erbray, and the headmaster at the time was A.R. Hilton, who had quite a destination in agricultural training. The number of students was not as great as in other high schools, and the classrooms were in rooms which were to have been part of a boarding house. So we did the first year in the kitchen, we did the second year in what was to have been the dining room, the third year was in what was to have been the study room in the evenings, and the final year was in the maid's quarters upstairs. Apparently, the six of us, who were the largest leaving class that they'd ever had, made too much noise, so we were pushed off to the library, which was a separate room across the pathway from the main building. It was a great experience, and one of the great virtues of Erbray, with its agricultural interest, was that each year, even though it was wartime, they would take their students up to Rosewood Agricultural College to give them an overview of what was available following the leaving class, or the intermediate, as the case may be. The first time that I ever went to Roseworthy under those circumstances was in 1942, and subsequently each year thereafter, but not in the leaving class. So on completion of Erbray, and still wanting to be a recognisable cocky, if I can put it that way, with somebody who'd taken the opportunity to get all the training that I possibly could in agriculture, I elected to go to Rosewood Agricultural College, and applied for a scholarship which was available, and subsequently was successful in obtaining the scholarship, which was for 3 years at Roseworthy. In those days, there were a total of only 70 students at Roseworthy. Being wartime, the numbers were not great, and the second and third year in particular, was rather short on numbers because some people had reached the age of entry into the forces and headed off to the war. There were 35 of us started as first years, but not 35 finished. It was a very changeable issue. One of those people who started out was a return serviceman who decided to get training in agriculture. He only saw the first year out, as several others did. And so by the time we graduated, as I said, there were six of us. Two of those had undertaken the intermediate in 2 years rather than in the 3 years that the majority of us took. So of the final six in the leaving class, there were four who had been there for 3 years and into their fourth, and two who had reached their intermediate within the 2 years, which was a possibility in those days. It was interesting in that there was an element of isolation having been pushed over to the library, but it was still a very rewarding experience that if while we were doing lectures or waiting for a lecturer to come and we wanted more information on some subject that had been discussed earlier that day, we could hop into the library and see if we could find some reference. So in that regard, it was a real plus. Herbray spent a lot of time in teaching students from the first year onwards in pruning. They had their own orchard, they had their own vineyard, and as a result of that experience, my pocket money during the 4 years that I was at Herbray was made from the neighbours and relatives pruning their trees and their vines. On one occasion, we even went down to one of the bigger vineyards down towards Flinders University, or where Flinders University is now, and spent whole days down there undertaking pruning on their vines. I would rate my involvement with Roseworthy and the fact that there was an introduction on the way through come year three to a junior agricultural bureau, which saw a meeting once a month on a Friday evening with a guest speaker specially selected to talk in terms which was suitable for young people on a range of agricultural activities. And thus there was an added impetus, if I can put that, and an added interest in the training that we got from Herbray. It certainly put me in good stead for being able to apply to Rosewood, the Agricultural College, with a background which was well-based. And I was fortunate that my entry to Roseworthy was for the full 3 years without any renewal of interest to get to the second year or the third year. It was for the full 3 years. At Roseworthy, as I mentioned, there were a number of people who didn't survive. As first years, we were subject to, I would have to admit, somewhat brutal input from the senior students as part and parcel of the initiation. It taught me one thing, which I still utilise today. Having reached 89 2 days ago, on the 25th of October, I still have a cold shower every morning, but after a warm one. And that came about from the fact that the senior students would use the bathrooms before we would, and certainly as part of the initiation ceremony, when we were rolled in molasses and mud and chaff and various other bits and pieces, the only way of getting clean for the rest of that night was with cold water. And I also ran a very interesting steeplechase. The first year students were engaged to do several circuits of the oval with observation by the senior students, and then the first year students were auctioned to the senior students, who took one or two or more of the first year students and made sure that they trained for a cross country, which was through vineyards and over small fences and on bitumen and on dirt. I had the good fortune of finishing up third in the derby, and was immediately dobbed in as a dark horse because my size didn't really settle to being able to reach any great destinies in the game. We were actually, as a result of the work on the oval in the first instance, given handicaps, and my handicap was obviously an advantage for me to be able to get on to number three. We also had the fact of quite often being woken in the middle of the night by the senior students coming in and deciding to put our beds out through the windows down onto the foreground of the cottage. A disturbance which lasted for a short time. And one of the other exciting activities was to line up all of the first year students, some on the shafts and others on ropes, to what was a 5-horse drag piece of equipment, with all the second and third year students aboard, and down the road, which was dirt in those days, down the road to the school, down a little further on the road to Roseworthy.
Is that at Kangaroo Flat? Is that
Kangaroo Flat?
Oh yeah.
So when one of the people alongside me who was in the shaft, and that was David Hardy from the Hardy Wine Group, went under one of the wheels, it was a rather quieter return to college than had been the case when we were urged to get to Kangaroo Flat ASAP.
Oh, was he okay?
He was okay after a period of time on crutches. But it's inevitable, I suppose, that if you're in a unusual situation, anything might happen. Mm-hmm. It did happen, but it finished up okay. Towards the end of the first year, the input from the higher grade students was not as great as had been. the work groups that were formed each day that we were on outside work compared with when we were doing lectures was with senior students who were overseeing our activities, particularly in the stables and in the dairy, in the piggery. If we were on the farm doing chaff cutting or driving a team, ploughing or whatever, we were more by ourselves rather than as part and parcel of a team. But it was a very, very rewarding experience with an oversight by staff who'd been on the college for quite a long period of time. And in staff in this particular instance, I'm talking about those who were the outside staff, who were agricultural minded people who had been farmers or who had handled students to show them how to do the right thing. Late in October of the first year in 1944, a call went out one Sunday night from the college veterinarian, Dr. Phil Schinkel, to seek some assistance down in the horse area to stomach pump a number of mares and foals that had broken into a wheat crop. Several of the group had already passed away before they were found up in the paddock, and it was as a result of that experience helping the veterinarian that I said, even though I wanted to be a cocky, I'll be close to the cockies by becoming a veterinarian. In the evenings, we would have a period from 7 o'clock to 8:30 for study. We were not allowed to leave our room, and first years were in dormitories up top. And a member of the staff would come in and tick us off to make sure that we were there and we were doing the right thing. And Mr. Hickenbotham, Alan Hickenbotham's father, who was very much involved in oenology and the chemistry area, came in one night to mark the roll and decided to ask each of the five of us what we were going to do on completion of the Roseworthy course. When he got to me, I said, "I'm going to do veterinary science, sir." "Forget it, there's no future in it." I was able to prove him wrong
just a little bit.
In many ways. But it was just an interesting circumstance that qualified veterinary practitioners were few and far between. For example, when I did come back and start at the end of 1951, having graduated from Sydney University, there were only 29 of us in the whole state of South Australia. And when I started at Gawler, the Gawler area, at the end of 1951, it was the first qualified veterinary practice north of Adelaide out through Darwin. Today, there are 9 veterinary practices in Gawler alone, with many of the country areas that were not serviced by veterinarians in the past, for example, just north of here, Clare, Kapunda, up to Port Pirie, Port Augusta, and so it goes on. So my experience of travel was very fulsome. I had an arrangement with the local Holden dealer that I would change in and out of a vehicle at 20,000 miles for £100. And the shortest time I owned one was 13 weeks. when it had its 20,000 miles up.
Wow.
If you got the situation, for example, that you were at clear three times in the one day, early in the morning for a cow with milk fever, and midday perhaps to treat a horse with colic, or going on back up at night time to do a calving case, 56 miles from Gawler to Clare, and 56 miles back, times by six, is a fair amount of travel. But the service also provided for assistance up the River Murray, down York Peninsula, up almost to Port Pirie, and down, more specifically, to Salisbury, because in 1951, when I started at Gawler, Gawler had a population of about 6,000 people. Salisbury, which came up almost as far as the Smithfield Hotel, had a population of only 4,000. But they did have 5,000 dairy cows.
Oh, yeah. Bruce, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's get back to Rosalie, and we'll get back to that in a minute. Yeah. Now, the other day you talked about some of the dances and stuff that you used to have there in the Tin Tabernacle.
Some of
the dances that you had? You had dances?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. What?
It was an annual ball, which was conducted in the dining room. And the students would prepare the dining room by dusting the floor with sawdust and shuffling around to bring it up to scratch so that it was a good dancing surface. The members would then proceed down to Adelaide to pick up a car or to find some means of getting their friends up to the ball. And we had a situation where the staff provided a magnificent supper. We had a local band which was really wonderful in the sense of having been commonly used around the wide area for township dances. Opposite Roseworthy College, and it's still there, was a tin shed which we used to call the Tin Tabernacle. It had a beautiful dance floor. It was used for indoor bowls earlier in the week, but each second Saturday night it would have a local dance with local people providing the music, and the local mothers would arrive with their daughters and their sons and so forth with a suitcase full of supper, knowing that it was going to be an unusual night with quite a lot of Roseworthy College boys who didn't normally get supper. So it was interesting. What the mothers didn't know, or didn't let on that they knew, was that some of their daughters were up for every dance, because these second and third year people, if they thought that a first year had a transgression during the week, would indicate that he would have 3, 2, 1, whatever the case may be, dances with so-and-so. And those persons who were nominated because they were rather bigger than others or were perceived to be in need of help that they mightn't otherwise get, spent the whole night on the dance floor. It was an interesting activity. And I finished up being the MC of the Guide Hall dance for the second and third year. Over and above the local one, there was also frequent dances at Wasley's, at Freeling, in Roseworthy Township itself, and members of the college were frequently in Tagawler Township, which is approximately 7 miles at that stage, either by push bike or by a college jinker to have a dance. At the end of the Second World War, which occurred while we were there, there was a dance for the victory. And I and many others of the college and elsewhere were present on the Saturday night when there were 738 people at the dance in the Gawler Institute to celebrate the victory. There was also a picture theatre in Gawler, and that was quite frequently attended by students. Only on Saturday nights, because you couldn't go out during the week. And that leads to the fact that students were only in receipt of one exit per term on a weekend. They were expected to be on college not only for the work that was to be done, but they were also expected to be part and parcel of the football teams, the cricket teams, the swimming team, or whatever. And it was a great experience of living with other people from all around the state, and also in our particular case with a couple from interstate, one from Sydney and one from Perth, of getting to know other people and being with them 24/7, 7 days a week, with just the one break to go home, if home was accessible, per term. And that was another part of the great history of. It was also at the end of the term a matter of a graduation ceremony. And when I say the end of the term, term of Roseworthy education commenced in March of each year and went through till February, early March the following year. This was to give students the opportunity of preparing for a crop, putting in a crop, harvesting a crop, stacking a crop, and then at the end of that you had seen a complete agricultural year. So that the graduation was at that particular time.
Bruce, what were some of the other like routines of being a student, like you know, what time do you get up and meals and study times and stuff like that? What sort of routines did you have? Daily routines did you have as part of being a student?
Well, breakfast was, from my recall, at 7 o'clock. But if you were on dairy duty, you were woken at 4:30 and you went down and in a team to do the dairy work. If you were on horses, and there wasn't only one or two tractors on the college in those days, all of the farm work was done by horses. If you were on horses, you were on the way down at 5:30, then you came back for breakfast at the end of that term. Lectures normally started at 8 o'clock and went through to about 4:30, 5 o'clock, with a hour and a half break for lunch. One of the other features of a weekend was that the ministers of religion in Gawler were on a cyclical basis providing a religious service in one of the front rooms of the college. And the housemaster, who was John Chambers at the time, made sure that everybody was in attendance. What he didn't know was that the senior students would sit at the back, and when there was a prayer on, a number of them would go out the window. I don't know what the result would have been if he'd woken up to the fact, but I can imagine it'd be disastrous, because John was a real disciplinarian, albeit a great fellow. And I had a very great experience of John, in the sense that during the second year, while I was killing a sheep for the kitchen, I unfortunately slipped and cut the tendon in my left thumb. And it was back in the days before, or the very, very early days of penicillin, and people who were potentially going to finish up with infection were put onto sulfonylides. I had stitches in at Gawler, plaster on the thumb, and having to take, in the middle of winter, 2 gallons of water per day, and sulfonamides, like wagon wheels, every 6 hours. John Chambers was in my room, 6 a.m., midday, 6 p.m., and 6 midnight at night, to make sure that they were. John and I had a far greater experience years later. He went, after Rosewithy, went back to teaching in Gawler, and was responsible for the Gawler Technical College and subsequently the TAFE. He was also the secretary and a fellow charter member of the Gawler Rotary Club when it started in 1954. Unfortunately passed away some years ago whilst on holiday in London, but some person that you would never forget because of the input they had to an individual's, albeit a student's, well-being.
Were there other staff members who you can remember had an impact on you as well?
Yeah, I would say that all of them certainly left an impact. I sometimes look sideways at Mr. Hickenbottom after his earlier response to my intention to do veterinary science, but no, they were. And the other thing is that the lecturers lived on college. They were there with their families. Their children were taken into Rosewithy School in the morning. Their older children would come back on weekends after having been at teachers' college or university. For example, I mentioned earlier Alan Hickenbottom. Alan Hickenbottom was a school teacher before he went into the building industry. He was also a great footballer. They're people that you meet on the way and you know. Rosewithy, even today, is still a great source of enjoyment to me when I go out there. I'm amazed at the fact that what some 10, 12 years ago looked like the closure of Rosewithy has turned the corner, and that over $40 million has been spent on the facilities for the veterinary course, and that the chance of Rosewithy disappearing is a no-no. But it was because on the conclusion of the Rosewithy College as an individual organisation and in its conjunction with the Adelaide University, that the oenology people elected to head to Adelaide, a lot of the agricultural work went to Adelaide, albeit that some of their students would come up and spend some time to get experience in at Roseworthy. And when students weren't relied on to milk cows on weekends because of the staff to supervise them, were going to cost somewhere between $1,100 and $1,200 for the 2 days. The dairy went, the piggery went, the individual piggery went, and Roseworthy as a training centre wasn't quite the same as it had been from day one back in 1883.
Did you, you're talking about staff, did you, I think you might have said the other day that the football coach was also the cook?
Yes.
What was the food like? Was he a good cook?
Good cook. There were two cooks, the senior, Jack Osborne, and the next one, whose name slips my memory just at the moment, but the college staff, with one exception, was entirely male. And the one exception was a girl who assisted the secretary in the main office. It's a rather different world today with the balance of students and the staffing and so forth. I'm not decrying it at all. But when I went back to Sydney in 2001 to celebrate the 50th anniversary of graduating as a veterinary surgeon, the dean of the faculty at a evening dinner stood up, looked around quite deliberately and said, "Lady and gentlemen." He said, "I realised that when you went through and concluded your training in 1951, there was one female and 75 males." Now, Sydney at that stage was the only university in the whole of Australasia that was training veterinarians, so that there were the Tasmanians, there were the Western Australians, the South Australians, there was the Southern Malaysia, New Zealand, a very different world. But yes, he said, "But I would have you know that in every veterinary faculty across Australia at the present moment, in every year, there is between 80 and 85% female students." A very different situation. And that's something which is certainly to be seen at Roseworthy at the present moment with its veterinary course. The number of males going through are very, very minor compared with the number of females, and have been for the three graduations which have taken place so far, with another one to take place any time now.
When you say your student days, it was a very male-dominated environment, did that influence how people behaved, or what they addresses, you know, what they wore? Was there a common outfit that people wore? Was there in those days, like everyone wear ties all the time? What was the norm?
Well, you're always expected to be respectable, and for the dances on the Saturday night, you would at least dress up presentably in the same gear as you would wear if you were going home for the weekend. The work gear was always necessary to be serviceable, and well maintained.
Did you do your own washing?
Did the own washing on college, yes. there were lines that we could take it down, and back in those days the students were entirely first years upstairs in the main building, and the second and third years in what's known as the corridor, down just beyond the original kitchen and the bathroom. The only toilets were down almost where one of the high-rise duplex places is now for students. So you got the call in the middle of the night, and it was wet. It wasn't a very comfortable experience. But that was the sign of the times. It was farm life. There was no sewerage as we know it, and no sewerage available. It was all long drop. It was able to be lived with, if I can put it that way.
Did you, with your like the daily routine? You said you got up at breakfast at 7. What about, was there a did they have like a bell to tell you the times of the day? Did you hear some sort of?
Yes, it would be a buzzer would go, which would alert people to what time of the day it was, and you sort of responded to that. The start of lectures in the morning, again, would be a buzzer. If the buzzer wasn't working, you were still expected to be where you were supposed to be at the time that you were supposed to be.
I can remember there used to be a bell hanging behind the old kitchen, and did they used to use that as a, so you could hear it a bit further away?
Yeah, it would ring at the start of breakfast as a matter of course.
Yeah.
It was more a relic of the past rather than the current method of management. But some of the male members of the kitchen staff had been there for years and years, and they were as much part of the history of the college in one sense as others. They rode bikes up to Wasley's where they lived, or they rode bikes into Gawler where they lived. There were only four of the outside staff that lived adjacent to college property, on the Wasley's Road and back over the hill beyond the old swimming pool. They weren't part of the group who were the teachers. They were the persons who were providing the assistance in the practical sense. Oh,
so like the farm staff.
Farm staff.
Oh yeah, okay. Can you remember any of the meals? Like, I guess you had a lot of mutton and eggs and that sort of stuff. Was there, I guess most food was all produced on the college, wasn't it? It was all grown there, or very little was brought in?
Yes, it was material came up by train to Roseworthy railway station and came out on the college ute or college truck along with the mail for those things that had to be supplied from Adelaide. Milk was produced on site, eggs were produced on site, meat was produced on site. As I say earlier on about being killing a sheep one day when I suffered an injury, that was a regular training exercise.
Because the war was on, so how did they? You would have been on rations for a lot of things. So how did they manage that as a as an institution, you all would have had a ration book, wouldn't you?
Yes.
So how do they manage that? They would have been a bit complicated.
Oh, you had to submit your documents to them, and they managed them through the office.
Yeah. So did you feel, were there many restrictions on your drink as a student during the wartime, do you think? I know there wasn't much petrol about.
The restrictions, the only restriction that occurred relative to students was that it was elected, or it was indicated that it was a no alcohol intake circumstance. And there were grave problems for those who failed to do the right thing if they went to one of the local dances and were found out. During the final 2 years that I was at Roseworthy, ex-service people were coming back to follow on their course or to start a course. And what the college did was to go out to the Sandy Creek prisoner of war camp, which had been an army camp for the Americans, and bring in four of their houses or their housing units. And they were placed down towards the dairy factory, away and behind some bushes, further removed from the main room and where the other students were. There was an element of forgiveness for people in those areas, but it was really a provision for those more senior people who had experienced Army, Air Force, Navy life and had been accustomed to taking alcohol as part and parcel of their weekly input.
Mm.
They showed some nous in making sure that they were isolated from the rest of the students.
And how did they get on with the students? It would be a lot younger than them and less experienced. So did they mix well?
Yes, mixed quite well. It's rather interesting that I mentioned earlier that there were 35 of us started in first year in 1944. When we graduated in 1947, there were 20 of us, and 9 of those 20 were ex-service people who'd come back and joined the course. And not only were 9 of them ex-service people, but of the 20, there were 7 who were or subsequently married Gawler girls.
Oh, bit of local talent.
It was one of those things that was an inevitable expectation, I think, that having spent those years from, 16, 17 through, people were going to dances, we were meeting up with people who they were seeing over a 3-year period, and as opportunity permitted. Quite interesting, the statistics of those of that early year in 1947. Prior to the graduation ceremony, and on the last night before students were allowed to leave the college before coming back for the graduation, there was always a dinner. And I never forgot Alan Callahan, or Sir Alan as he subsequently became known, who stood up and said, "Gentlemen, I know some of you are going to go to the university. He said, I would have you know that we have never authorised somebody to go to university and they've let us down. It was quite a stimulus to me personally when I started at Sydney University in 1947, 2 weeks after I graduated from Roseworthy, that having never undertaken physics in my life, first year physics at Sydney University was a challenge.
Academically, you did quite well at Roseworthy. You had the silver medal and you got first class or second class honours in third year. What happened to you?
Yes, I finished up with the first class diploma and the second in total. I was doing something that I really enjoyed and had headed me in the direction of something else I knew I was going to enjoy. It was also fairly important for yet another circumstance. In those days, to go to university, you had to have an intermediate language. And because at Erbray there was never opportunity for teaching of a language, I would not have been recognised as a legitimate candidate for university. Well, when I wrote to Sydney University explaining what my background was and that I would be graduating with a diploma, they indicated that so long as the diploma had a honours with it, they would admit me on a special opportunity. And through the 5 years at Sydney University, I would front up and sign in each year, indicating that I was a special applicant.
So let's see, where are we? We're getting close towards your finishing at Roseworthy. That was in end of 47. Then you went straight away to Sydney. And you got a scholarship there to go, didn't you?
Yes, the Department of Agriculture used to make available scholarships to go to Sydney University to do veterinary science. The figure for first year was £100. Second, third, fourth and fifth was £165 plus a return fare by train to Sydney via Melbourne. I was of the opinion that if you were going to do a university course, it was far better to do the whole course in the one place than to break it and then go with another circle of people. And I was granted the opportunity by the Department of Agriculture to do so. And so I went straight there for the first year and never regretted it. The other thing was that the scholarship which was available, and I must just come back and say that the Department of Agriculture did give me the second year for the first year because I was going to be in Sydney. But the other thing is that the requirement of having received a scholarship from the Department of Agriculture was that one would return to South Australia for not less than 3 years upon graduation, and under all normal circumstances would be a member of the Department of Agriculture. The situation was changed for one person in 1950 when a former Roseworthy student and a dedicated veterinarian who went on to be a professor at both Brisbane and Sydney universities, in the late Rex Butterfield, applying for the opportunity to commence a rural practice. Back in 1950, the only rural practices of qualified people in South Australia were Mount Barker, Victor Harbour, Charleston, where Rex Butterfield commenced, Mount Gambier, and Narracourt. And when it came to 1951, I requested of the Department of Agriculture that I be given the same privilege as Rex had received by starting a rural practice. And my wife-to-be at that stage and I, during the year leading up to the final exams in 1951, sat down with hundreds of maps of South Australia and the results that used to be put out, and I think are still put out each year, for the stock numbers in all of the districts. We put a 15 mile circle around 36 country towns in South Australia. And when it was finally looked at and we took out the figures for the various animals, it came down to the possibility of Murray Bridge or Gawler. Gawler had a greater diversity of livestock with quite a large number of studs. Certainly the centre for British breed sheep, quite a number of horse studs, and so it went on. And I decided that had anything happened to the dairy industry at Murray Bridge, that it could be disastrous, and that it was far better to look at Gawler. And Gawler was accepted. Some of the senior veterinarians in the Department of Agriculture said he'd be back looking for a job in 6 months. A little bit like Hickenbotham, he thought there was no future in Gawler. But as I said earlier, the fact of the dairy industry, 5,000 cows at in and around Salisbury, all the studs that were here, the fact that there was nobody else north of here, and then lo and behold, what should happen in 1955? And they declared that they are going to have a new town called Elizabeth. A lot of the early people moving into Elizabeth were British Air Force people, because at that stage the V bombers were out here as part and parcel of the Maraninga activities, etc. And they brought with them their habits of having animals and really looking after them by seeking veterinary advice. The Housing Trust built a surgery for me down at Elizabeth, which I moved into in 1959. And it was like the tail of the dog wagging the practice. There was a stage where I started to take on assistant veterinarians. We'd go down there on a Tuesday and Thursday nights, and you might have 45 people through the door with their animals. We'd go down on a Wednesday to undertake spaying operations for the dogs and the cats. And you would have 20-25 animals lined up for the surgery ahead of doing an afternoon clinical. activity. It also had another aspect which was reinforced to me by my very first assistant. My very first assistant was a lad, the son of a Latvian veterinary surgeon called Janis Priedkans. And Janis Priedkans was with me, and at home one night, having come back from the clinic, handed in the cash and so forth, stopped to have a coffee, and he said, "It doesn't suit me to know that I trained to save animals and I've got so many people coming in wanting their animals euthanized." What the English people would commonly do is thoroughly enjoy their animal, but when they were headed for home and couldn't take it, were not prepared to allow it to go to somebody who might let it stray, who mightn't look after it in the same way it had been looked after.
Mm.
The same Janis Priedkans went on to do some work in the Adelaide Hills and then went overseas for different training. He came back here in the late 1970s as the Dean of the Faculty of Medicine at the Adelaide University.
Oh.
Quite an amazing circumstance. But his thoughts were quite understandable.
Oh.
But on reflection, the benefit of the particular animal was key in the minds of the people going back to England. That practice at Elizabeth moved up some years ago to Smithfield and is still going, as is the practice that I started at here in Gawler, up at Williston. The first 9 months that I was in practice in this area, from December 51 through, we lived in a house out between Cockatoo Valley and Lindock. Gawler had 500 telephone lines, and if you had a house in Gawler and wanted to put yourself on the telephone line, you went on to a shared line, and telephone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning and all hours of the day and night would hardly go down too well with the people that you're charging with. Fortunately, when a house became available here, another 100 lines had been made available, and so I had the great opportunity of being able to move in with my own independent line and no problems.
So things have changed a bit, haven't they, with mobile phones and things?
Yeah.
You said a while ago, I think, that you also were the backup vet for Roseworthy when you were at the Gawler practice.
Yes, Roseworthy made use of my service for any clinical work which was necessary, mainly on weekends or if the college veterinarian, and they'd normally have one or two, but there were occasions when there were no one appointed. And in actual fact, in the early 60s, I also lectured the first and the third years on veterinary subjects. So my opportunity to get away from Roseworthy never occurred. And of course it never occurred much later when I became a member of the Roseworthy College Council and subsequently was responsible for the signature that went on the document along with Dame Roma Mitchell.
So you started that in 83 and then went right through to 91, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The up until the decision was made in 1989 when we signed the document which came to the amalgamation. It was a matter of talking to the three universities which existed in South Australia. University of South Australia, Flinders and Adelaide. And there were certain virtues of similarities in some aspects of the opportunities that were available in both in any one of those conjunctions. And after we'd been talking for some time and getting close to there needing to be a decision, the local federal treasurer arrived on the scene, an ex-Roseworthy college graduate, and said, "I'll have you know that there will be but one parcel of money for agricultural training in South Australia." So it automatically meant that John Dawkins was telling us that we had to go with Adelaide University. It was by no means a shock or something which we regretted, because Roseworthy and Adelaide University had been in conjunction with one another for quite a number of years. And indeed, when I was a student at Roseworthy in the 40s, we had agricultural graduate students up two nights a week getting practical on-site experience. And there had been other occasions when the two organisations had been working with one another. So the discussions took place, the final decision to make the amalgamation was worked on the basis of taking effect as from the 1st of January 1991, and with the grace of Adelaide University, the graduation of the 1990 students from Roseworthy was permitted to be granted at Roseworthy, and as a guest speaker on the day, we had Sir Alan Callaghan with his long experience of Roseworthy as the guest speaker. Oh. It all finished quite well. The Adelaide University made sure that they had a senior officer sitting on the top table, but they sanctioned it, and it was much appreciated that people who'd done the whole of their course on Roseworthy were able to undertake their graduation on site.
With the College Council, was that like a broad policy group that you didn't do any day-to-day stuff? It was about broad policy on how the college is run, or how did that work?
In my days as a student, the Roseworthy College, in effect, was almost a subsidiary of the Department of Agriculture. And then in the later years, it was decided that it would become a College of Advanced Education.
So that was 74, would that be?
Yes. Yeah. And the change took place there, and instead of people from Adelaide necessarily ruling the roost or deciding what would be done at Roseworthy, it became a more balanced or group as a college council. And it was in 1983 when I was appointed by the then Minister of Agriculture to become a representative of the minister, and 12 months later, at the official annual general meeting, I was elected by my peers on the council as the council chairman, and so remained as the council chairman right up to and inclusive of the final occasion.
So when, in that January 91, was there any sort of, did your duties just stop then as being on the council, and the university sort of took over everything from that day?
Yes, there was no involvement directly, albeit that I was sometimes called upon to go to the university and give some background about what had taken place. Roseworthy students became part of the alumni of the Adelaide University, and wearing another hat as a member of Parliament. The university was running a special luncheon once a year for Adelaide University graduates who were members of the federal or the state Parliament. And it was an opportunity once again to mix with the Vice-Chancellor and the others and follow through. Much the same time, we decided that there needed to be a foundation, and after some considerable thought and discussion, I chaired for several years the Roseworthy College Foundation, which provides and still is providing opportunities for students to get scholarships. Foundations take some time to become of real value. Their real opportunity to become what we might call virtually all time is the receipt of beneficiaries from ex-students' wills. In the meantime, you're relying on income from any function that you run, plus donations from ex-graduates. Whether it be at a university, at a high school, or at a college, or wherever else, there are some lengthy meetings wondering where the next dollar is going to come from. But eventually it's all worthwhile. And so it is with the college, which was mentioned at the dinner last week.
Yeah. You've left your mark in Roseworthy in various ways as well, because you've had a few things named after you, haven't you? You tell us about those things?
Yes, the first occasion, and earlier this year, it was 25 years ago, the major library building was destined to become the Eastick Building, and it was opened by Dame Roma Mitchell, as a matter of fact. At the commemoration of 25 years earlier this year, it was interesting to meet up with a number of the people who had been on the staff at that time and to recollect at how important the library has become, plus rooms for a number of college staff. With the veterinary degree. might have even been slightly before the transfer to the Adelaide University, I was enticed to become the patron of the Roseworthy Residential Organisation. The mayor of, or the chairman of the District Council of Light, in which Roseworthy exists, had been the chairman for quite a number of years beforehand. He was from agricultural background out at Gawler River. And on his death, I became the chairman. When the first veterinary graduation took place, the Old Scholars Association, particularly with the late Fred Taylor, Fred, isn't it amazing, yeah. But
Ray Taylor.
Hmm?
Ray
Taylor, yeah. Decided that they were going to give a trophy or an award in the name of Bruce Eastick for Doctor of Veterinary Medicine. And that has taken place each year since then. On the very first occasion, prior to the meeting, I was walking around talking to various people, and a lady came up, fronted me and said, "Do you know who I am?" I said, "No." And she said, "I was your daughter's best mate at Gawler High School." I said, "Oh, and your grandmother, mother and father were amongst my first clients when I came to Gawler as a veterinarian." Mm. She said, "Yes." And she said, "This is my daughter." Lo and behold, who should come up to collect the prize, but it was her daughter, who's now practising at, or was, after graduation, practising at Strathalbyn.
Oh,
so the name persists in that sense, that Roseworthy is obvious, I think, from the discussion we've had this afternoon, has played quite a prominent part in my history, and one which I've respected and thoroughly enjoyed.
Okay, well, thank you, Bruce. Well, we'll conclude there, and we thank once again thank you, Bruce, for making the opportunity to give us a bit of your past. There's a lot there, but we had a look at some of it, and Roseville is certainly very grateful for your, I guess, being there and following through and supporting it, and still part of it to this day. So we'll meet again for perhaps another talk.
Right.
Thank you, Bruce.